You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. If you're listening for the first time, this is a preview station for Kick-Ass Politics, where I put up a few sample episodes for you to check out. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like it, then I encourage you to go to our main program at Kick-Ass Politics and subscribe to the show. There are a lot more episodes there. Just search for Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes, or if you go to the information page for this episode on iTunes, there's a link right there to subscribe to the main show. Also, feel free to check out our webpage at kickasspolitics.com, where you'll find show notes, book recommendations, and all kinds of extras. I'm Ben Mathis, and I hope you enjoy this preview of Kick-Ass Politics. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And right now, Audible.com has a special promotion for listeners of Kick-Ass Politics. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial by going to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics or click on the sponsor link on our webpage at kickasspolitics.com. Remember when you were a kid and an adult, probably a parent or a teacher, first taught you to share? Maybe it was a toy or candy that you shared with a classmate or a best friend, or perhaps your mom told you to let your brother ride your bicycle. Sure, you resisted at first, but eventually you came to learn that when we all shared, everyone benefited. But then you grew up, and somewhere along the way, all the cynics in the world convinced you that sharing and self-interest really don't mix. Well, guess what, folks? Sharing is making a comeback. And I'll be talking about it today with Grover Norquist, president and founder of Americans for Tax Reform. All that and more in today's podcast.
From Hollywood to Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. Now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
There's an economic insurgency going on, and it's changing how we buy, sell, and rent just about everything. They're calling it the sharing economy. You might also know it as the collaborative economy or peer-to-peer business, and in the past 5 years, it's exploded into a $26 billion business. With an astonishing annual growth rate of 25%, the sharing economy is the fastest growing business sector in the global economy. And if you've ever used Uber or Lyft or Sidecar, then you're a part of it. But car services are only the tip of the iceberg. Say you're going to New York. With Airbnb, you can pay to crash on someone's couch or rent their guest room for a fraction of the cost of a hotel. Expensive New York restaurant? Who needs them? You can attend a fancy private dinner party with locals thanks to another sharing economy app called EatWith. Want some extra shopping money while you're on your trip? Go on an app called PiggyBee and find someone in your town who will actually pay you to deliver a package while you're on vacation. And if you've got a bike or a pair of skis or even a parking space, somewhere there's someone who wants to pay to use it. The point is this. Everything in your closet or your garage, every skill you possess, and every free hour in your day has value to someone. And thanks to the internet, people are getting connected like never before and making the most of our collective resources. They're buying, selling, borrowing, renting, bartering, exchanging, and they're even making new friends in the process. The sharing economy is putting extra coin in the pockets of Americans struggling through hard times, and for some, it's making everything they ever wanted far more accessible and affordable than they ever imagined. Oh, and just a side bonus, it's great for the environment, too. Everybody loves the sharing economy. Well, almost. You see, some bureaucrats and politicians in state and local governments from San Francisco to New York want to regulate, tax, and in some cases, completely eliminate these peer-to-peer businesses. Why would they want to spoil the fun for everyone? I've got two words for you. Labor unions. Well, today I'm going to get to the bottom of it with my guest, Grover Norquist. Grover is the president and founder of Americans for Tax Reform. He also serves on the board of the American Conservative Union and the NRA. He's a contributing editor to American Spectator magazine, and he's written three books, including Leave Us Alone, Getting the Government's Hands Off of Our Money, Our Guns, and Our Lives. Today, he's joining me on the podcast via Skype. Grover, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Grover, you recently co-wrote a really interesting article that talked about the sharing economy as a winning issue for Republicans. And I think that a lot of conservatives get scared off by this notion of the shared sharing economy because it sounds vaguely socialist.
Can I have a bite of your ice cream cone?
Yeah, that's exactly. Sharing. Exactly.
You give me
sharing
your stuff.
The wealth, as Obama would say. But really, you know, what the sharing economy or the peer-to-peer business, as some call it, is it's the essence of market capitalism. It's tearing down barriers. It's giving people greater access to goods and services at a better price. It's radically changing old, outdated distribution systems. And all of it really benefits the public good.
Oh, it is. And it's wonderful because, first of all, it's new, which means it isn't regulated because they haven't figured out how to regulate it. They haven't figured out how to tax it yet. They haven't set the dead hand of government on top of your shoulder to tell you what you can and can't do. It's created tens and hundreds of thousands of entrepreneurs, of independent businessmen and women. The guys at Uber run their own businesses, right? It's their car. They're not somebody's employee. You know, renting part of your home to somebody briefly, you're a business person. Being able to sell to anyone in the United States or the world through the internet, what Amazon has done and many other companies that are a lot smaller than Amazon. And the only thing our friends, the politicians in state capitals in Washington, D.C., think about or care about is how do we tax this? How do we run this? How do we control this? How do we get our VIG? And their interests and the interests of the citizens and of individuals who become businessmen and women and consumers are completely at odds. Makes it very clear that the government is not there to protect you. They are standing there between you and your Uber driver.
There is this epic battle going on between those who want to innovate and those who just want to regulate. And it seems to me that in many of these cases, they really want to regulate and tax these companies out of business, at least in their cities.
Well, there's a business, you know, taxis, regulated, unionized taxi companies in Nevada and Las Vegas, for instance. They've already been put in harness. They pay massive taxes. They have a massive regulatory regime. They haven't had to innovate in decades because the government says, we're going to abuse you and pick your pocket and tell you what to do and make you inefficient. But you know what we'll also do? We're going to kneecap anybody who might compete with you. So don't worry about any costs we impose on you. You pass them on to the consumer. You don't need to worry about improving the quality because you can't have any competitors because we decide who can be a competitor. We're the government.
It's a little bit like the old school mafia. You know, they pay the protection money so they don't have to worry about competition.
It's a lot like that, yes. Not a little, a lot.
Yeah. Well, Attorney General of New York State has done everything he can to make life a living hell for anyone who uses Airbnb. I mean, it's to the point where he actually compelled Airbnb to hand over private information on all of their hosts in New York City.
Absolutely. And in tragically, obscenely, in Las Vegas, there are guys in ski masks surrounding Uber drivers and grabbing them. Ski masks, okay? Black ski masks. What's this about, right? What is it? They do that, I think, because they're embarrassed by what they're doing.
It's terrible. In New Jersey, you have cops pulling over Uber drivers and tossing passengers out on the street in the middle of the night and just leaving them there. It's despicable.
Yeah.
All that it is big government protecting the unions that put them in office, and doing so under the guise of protecting public safety.
Yeah.
Well, this exposes such a hypocrisy. Liberals say that they're for the environment, but here you have these innovative technologies. There's no question that companies like Uber and Lyft reduce CO2 emissions because it's essentially carpooling. People are using fewer cars when they're using Uber and Lyft. They make the maximum use of assets that would otherwise be dormant or be thrown away. This is a great thing for the environment. So how can liberals possibly make a case against this?
An efficient market is another way of saying less waste. Less wasted time, less wasted energy, less wasted gas, but less wasted, you know, everything. That's what free markets do. They reduce waste.
Right. And a big part of this idea is the philosophy that unused value is wasted value. Just because I'm not using my car or my guest room at my house every single hour of every day, that doesn't mean that someone else might not be interested in using it. It still has value.
How often do you need a kayak, right? I mean, some people kayak every day, I suppose, but there's quite a number of people who very rarely use a kayak and would love to be able to rent it to somebody who wants it for a weekend. Anytime you go out in the ocean or on a lake, take a look at 2/3, 4/5 of all the boats you see are at anchor. That weekend, on a good weekend with great weather, a lot of people are not using their boats. Why wouldn't you want people to make it easy to rent them to reduce the cost of maintaining a boat?
Right. And the people that derive the most benefit from peer-to-peer economies are really low and middle-income Americans. During the recession, a lot of people would have lost their home or been evicted from their apartment if it weren't for the extra income that they generated by renting out a spare room or their couch on Airbnb. 70% of Airbnbs in New York City are outside of the typical tourist districts. So that means that the guests at these Airbnbs, they're actually pumping money into neighborhoods that don't usually derive much economic benefit from tourism. That's a good thing. And the same goes for Uber and Lyft. A lot of people who lost their job during the recession, they still had a car, so they signed up for one of these rideshare services and they started making money and they became an independent contractor. There's no question that these businesses saved those people.
Oh, absolutely. This is so exciting. And here you have jobs being created, income being created, people, you know, making new friends and having new adventures. And the government goes, wait a minute. We didn't give you permission to do this.
I have friends who do Airbnb and they become friends on Facebook and they end up going out and doing things together and they've stayed in touch for years. It's becoming part of the culture and it's becoming a social movement.
Well, it's a bed and breakfast on steroids.
Well, certainly, I think it puts Democrat politicians in a tough spot because they're so beholden to employee unions that they're throwing their constituency under the bus here. Like we discussed, it's good for the environment. It's good for the poor and for middle-income Americans. I mean, Obama is always saying he wants to spread the wealth. Well, that's exactly what this does. Folks who can't afford a hotel can afford Airbnb. People who can't afford a car or a bike or a pair of skis now suddenly have access to these things for a reasonable price and they don't have to own them. It gives so many people so much more access than they ever had before. But it's not the government forcing people to spread the wealth. It's these individual citizens choosing to do so.
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing that's come up is Tesla wanting to be able to sell cars directly. That's against the law. It's a crime in 40-plus states. How'd that happen? You know, that's crazy.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Tesla because the thing that occurs to me in all of this is if government regulators are freaking out and going to such extreme lengths to protect taxi unions from rideshare apps, I shudder to think what they'll do 5 to 10 years from now when the first driverless cars hit the market.
Oh, dear, yes. That would be very, very interesting. And look, we need to develop both citizens. I think the American people are pretty open to all this new stuff. I mean, we do jump out and want to do and try all the new products and ideas and so on. And Uber, even in D.C., very much outside the law. Everybody fell in love with it. When the government, a little slow on the uptake, got around to trying to threaten it, there were so many people who were consumers of it, they told the government to back off, and it did.
That is amazing. You know, and you have San Francisco, 69% of the people in San Francisco love Airbnb. yet the lawmakers want to pass laws just like they have in New York City that outlaw short-term rentals and would essentially drive Airbnb out of the city.
Isn't that amazing? And San Francisco is where they invented Uber, not to set up a multi-billion dollar company, but because some friends said, you know, you can never get a cab in this stinking place. Why don't we set this up for us, you know, the 40 of us? And then it took off.
Now, in the article that you wrote, you said that all of this presents an interesting opportunity for the GOP to make political headway in traditionally liberal big cities. Come on.
Isn't it interesting that big cities tend to be run by Democrat political machines? The Republicans run, you know, 62% of all the governorships, more than that of all the state legislative bodies. And yet cities are run by Democrats elected by labor union structures and are the most resistant to change. What's supposed to make a city alive, like Rome or Carthage or Athens, is all the immigrants and the new people showing up and the new ways of doing things and all this stuff happening so much that there's all this learning going on all the time. Ron Unz was talking about some studies that point out that people's IQ goes up when they move to the big city from a rural area or when they move to a new country and have to learn a new language, new signs, new lights. And the act of immigrating raises your IQ. So cities ought to be more of that, and yet the structures, that the dead hand of these structures, the whole thing of a union contract, this is the next 5 years of how we do things. Really? Can you imagine if they'd done that to, you know, computer companies, you know, to Apple or Microsoft or any of these companies, when they got up and said, here's the job description. I mean, how many jobs the first year of Apple or Microsoft or Cisco, that 5 years later, that job didn't exist anymore, and new ones did. We can't have that kind of dead weight on the economy. We need to move away from that, and the Democrat Party can't. This is why the Republicans have this credible opportunity. Not having power in the cities, not having a bunch of mayors, they haven't cut any deals with the taxi company lobby. So they can be there cheering on all new disruptive technology. That's great. That's good. This is wonderful. Let's do this. And the Democrats have to go, well, we can't be for you until we figured out how to take care of the buggy whip manufacturers.
There's an economic concept of creative destruction, where outdated business practices are constantly being replaced by new and more innovative ones. And that really is what drives economies forward.
The guys who used to make buggy whips or candles went on to do other things. You know, they didn't sit in a corner and starve to death. Labor is mobile. And that's why you want a very flexible education system to make it easy for people to shift from one thing to another, not be locked into long-term labor contracts with all sorts of rules.
All right, folks, we're going to pause for a moment, and then I'll be back to talk with Grover about an experience that he had recently that really took this whole notion of the shared economy to the extreme. All right, back after the break. If you're enjoying this episode on the sharing economy, then I want you to check out our sponsor, Fiverr. That's F-I-V-E-R-R. Fiverr is the world's largest online marketplace for services, with over 100 categories covering just about everything you can imagine, and all offered for a fixed base price of just $5. If you're a student, you can find an English professor to proofread an essay for $5. You need a professional company logo? $5. Business cards, stationery design, composers to write a jingle for your business, people who promote your company on Twitter or radio, any kind of advertising you can possibly imagine, IT support, web design, translation, transcription, legal counseling, and someone to teach you just about anything you can possibly want, all for $5. And you didn't hear this from me, but kids, you can even go on Fiverr and find grad students who will do your math homework for you. In fact, when people ask where I found the voiceover artist who does our radio intro on the show, I tell them, Fiverr. I got a professional radio voiceover artist to do our intro for just $5. And now, if you go to the Kickass Politics website and click on the Fiverr ad under our sponsors, You'll be showing support for the show, and you'll get some great offers on services tailored to your needs. Whatever you need done, find it on Fiverr. And if you like what we're doing here at Kick-Ass Politics and you want to help keep us on the air, then please show your support for the show and make a donation by going to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. That's GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and even more interesting programs in the future. That's GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. I appreciate your encouragement and support. I'm back with Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform. We've been talking about the sharing economy and how disruptive businesses are really changing the world for so many people. Well, about a month or so ago, Grover had a pretty unique experience. You went to the Black Rock Desert of Nevada to experience, I guess, the ultimate sharing economy, a place where money has no value and there is no such thing as commerce. I'm, of course, talking about the annual Burning Man Festival. How in the world did they get Mr. Anti-Tax Free Market Capitalist Grover Norquist to go to Burning Man?
I did. It was great. Larry Harvey, one of the founders of it, of Burning Man, when it was 20 people watching an 8-foot-tall Burning Man burn on the beaches of California. Almost 30 years later now, there was a 120-foot-tall statue made out of wood, logs, big. It took 90 minutes to burn before the knees blew out of Burning Man. 70,000 people came together for 1 week in the middle of a desert, and they set up shop, and then they disappeared, and it's government-owned Bureau of Land Management, and it has to look like you weren't there, you know, afterwards and before, and it does, and they've been doing this for years now. So it is, you bring your own water, you bring your own food, you bring your own, you know, tents or living facilities. You can buy coffee and ice. Those are the two things you can buy with cash. Otherwise, you bring your own stuff, perfectly free to trade with other people.
That's one thing I never understood. People always tell me that it's a giving economy and there's no money. There's no you can't purchase anything except ice and coffee. The ice, I guess, I kind of understand, but coffee. Were you able to figure out why that is?
I think that people are not capable of producing for themselves and their friends enough coffee that tastes good.
Well, certainly some of these people are perhaps in altered states at that point in the morning, so I might not trust a cup of coffee from them.
But I had a couple of misconceptions about Burning Man. I was delighted to go. 2 years ago, Larry Harvey and the gang said, come on out. My wife and I were going to go out. It was the same week as the Republican National Committee, and I tweeted at the time, who is the idiot who put the Republican convention on the same week as Burning Man? And we had fun on the internet with people talking about what the overlap of that Venn diagram looked like.
Well, it sounds like a false choice to me. I mean, I don't know which place would be worse to be in August, the hot, dry Nevada desert or the stifling humidity of Tampa, Florida.
Yes. Oh, we had downpours in Florida. It was miserable.
That's right.
But 2 years later, it worked out. My wife and I went out there, and it was very interesting. I had a sense of what to expect, just as I had a sense of what I thought I'd see when I went to the Louvre in Paris. And the Louvre in Paris was impressive. It was a bunch of paintings in a nice palace. But it wasn't different than what I expected. I expected interesting, but it wasn't different than that. Burning Man was more intense, deeper, bigger, more everything, to the point where it wasn't what I expected. Same thing when I went to Petra in Jordan. It's just so much more impressive than I could have imagined or ever did imagine. The number of people you run into, that you walk down the street, you walk into to people doing all sorts of different stuff, artwork everywhere. All the cars are art cars. There are not a lot of cars there, but the ones that are art cars. Dressed up like big spiders or cats or some of the really large ones on the back of flatbed trucks are pirate ships. It's when you let people alone and tell them, look, we got roads. Don't sit in the road. Don't put your tent in the road. But otherwise, it's up to you. And people leave each other alone, and they have a great time. I had thought, been hearing about a bunch of drug use, and everybody's naked or dressed oddly. That's because the pictures people take are of the guys who don't wear all their clothes or are dressed oddly.
Are we going to find scandalous pictures of you on the internet now?
You will find pictures of me, I think, basically wearing desert gear. I mean, sweat through long sleeve shirt that rolls up and desert pants.
Oh, well, okay. Well, you were smart then. You were getting ready to go to Iraq there or something.
Well, that's what it sounded like. I've worked in deserts before, and I said, I know what this is like.
Yeah.
So I dressed for that. But I did, because I talked to one conservative libertarian guy that had been going for years. He said, I bring two trunks of clothes. I said, well, I guess some people do dress up. And I don't know, 20%, 10% of people are sort of dressed up pretty funky, and some people go pretty crazy in a fun, interesting way. So I brought a Moroccan outfit that it makes you look like Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Oh, I love it. I see, I've always been afraid to go, but I figured if ever I was going to go, I would dress up like Lawrence of Arabia with the white headgear and
that
so
would
forth
work.
And all that.
That would work. But you also need goggles because it gets windy and dusty.
That's what I hear. Yeah, that's what I hear, which is that's very steampunk now. One of the things in an article you wrote about the experience was that you said it's a great example of the theory of spontaneous order. You know, you don't need a bunch of rules because it's largely self-policing and everyone gets along and there's actually very little trouble that goes on.
Yes. Yeah, it is. The idea, you know, who's going to do this? Who's going to do that? Look, people run their own lives. And people work things out. And yeah, I think there's probably some pharmaceutical experimentation going. I spoke to the Psychedelic Drug Association.
That's right. Now, how did that happen?
A friend of a friend said, you ought to come join and speak at our speakers series. And since I didn't have anything on my schedule, I felt more comfortable having something on my... I have a schedule now. I have something I have to do at a particular place. So I said, sure. So I show up, and it turns out I am the last speaker of a week-long series for the Psychedelic Drug Association, 200 people. we had a regular talk for an hour, and then I stayed for another hour and took every question that anybody had because it was the end of the evening. We didn't have to be anywhere. Didn't have an evening commute anywhere. And so for 2 hours, there were two questions on drug prohibition, and the rest were the same thing I talked to anybody about the nature of politics in the United States and how it works and what goes on and the prospects for liberty. It was great. It was great. And somebody put a cup of coffee next to me, and I didn't drink it.
Oh, well, that's smart. That's smart.
Turns out it was my wife.
Curious, did your experience speaking at, say, CPAC or Heritage Foundation prepare you for this?
Yes, that's right. the more mainstream characters at Burning Man.
So it's interesting because you talk about the concept of radical inclusiveness.
Yeah.
Did that surprise you? I always think of Burning Man as a very liberal institution, and I would think that there would be a lot of people who were not happy to see you there. But you say that that's not the case.
No, there was a bunch of articles written, Vanity Fair, Vice, the website, Huffington Post. People were outraged that a libertarian conservative was going and... I mean, five people, you know, but they have columns. And the good news is that the guys who founded it, you know, really slapped them down hard and said, we got 10 rules at Burning Man. The first one's radical inclusion. That's rule number one. And this is not some liberal gated community. And I did discover, because my name was out there on, you know, Twitter and so on, websites, all these people I hadn't seen in years. Oh, Grove, I've been going for a decade, 12 years, 5 years. And people were really reaching out to give me advice, and they were very political libertarians and conservative guys, and they just said, look, everybody does their own thing. There's an assumption, I think, because of some drug use, and maybe 1 out of 100 people are not completely wearing all the clothes that you would normally wear to work, that that, that this was some big liberal thing, but in point of fact, not, no.
One of the main ideas behind Burning Man is, as you mentioned, you can't buy anything other than coffee and ice. But there is this gifting culture that sprung up where people give things to each other purely out of altruism. What kind of gifts did you bring to hand out?
I brought two things. I brought some lip balm, one because I realized I would want much lip balm, and if somebody forgot theirs,
yeah,
they would want
it. That sounds like a very desirable item in the desert.
It is. The other is small flashlights because at night it is really dark and there are people on bicycles and just walking. Everybody needs to be lit up. And not everybody's got as much light as they ought to have on them. I brought Cuban cigars, which I thought was sort of vaguely edgy, Cuban, not completely legal, and yet, you know, tobacco, so edgy that way, not marijuana, so not completely edgy.
Well, if I'm at Burning Man next year, you're going to be the guy that I seek out in that
case.
I
will. I was very popular. I had well-received gifts.
Are you planning on going to Burning Man next year?
The answer is yes. Life gets difficult. Schedules get interesting. It took me 2 years to get there. It is my plan to go, my wife's plan to go. We are having a discussion about whether we can bring the children. There is a kiddie camp there. There's a place that makes it easy for people to
You can bring children to Burning Man.
You can indeed. Oh, there's a young lady. I had my fingernails painted black, very goth, by a six-year-old girl who was in and around the camp where we stayed. And at six, you don't exactly have fine motor skills. So my fingernails and much of each finger was painted black.
It sounds fun. I never thought that I would ever go to Burning Man, but it kind of sounds fun. Do you think we could talk Karl Rove into going?
I have suggested
or maybe Newt?
On television that some of the Republican congressmen I know that Rand Paul ought to go. They did interview him on one of the Hispanic stations, and he said, you know, I might be busy talking about maybe running for president.
Well, that should be a stop on every presidential tour, I think.
I think they should. Kucinich was there this year.
That's a natural choice for him, I would think. that's not so outside the box.
and McCarthy, the Republican whip, is thinking about getting out there.
Kevin McCarthy,
big high-tech guy.
Okay.
I think we're going to get a bunch of Republican congressmen to come through, sure.
I will say this. I'm glad that I had you to be the guinea pig on this one. but maybe next year. That's a big maybe for me, but... You never know. Stranger things have happened. I also want to mention that you, too, just launched your own podcast.
Yeah, associated with the Washington Times. They have distributions.
I've never heard of them. Is that a fly-by-night operation or something?
It's been around for a while, but the podcast thing is new.
I'm kidding. Well, terrific. Well, yeah, everyone should definitely tune in to Grover's podcast. So where can they find that? Do they go to washingtontimes.com or...?
Yeah, or I think you can YouTube it under Grover Podcast.
You are doing a yeoman's work out there in D.C. And folks, you ought to give Grover Norquist a pat on the back because I don't know anyone out there who is fighting harder to keep the government out of your wallets and out of your lives.
Appreciate the opportunity. Take care, Ben.
Hey, Grover, thanks for coming on the show. If you enjoyed today's episode, then I think you'll really like Grover's brand new book, End the IRS Before It Ends Us, How to Restore a Low-Tax, High-Growth, Wealthy America by my guest today, Grover Norquist. And right now, you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be Grover's new book, End the IRS Before It Ends Us, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics, or click on the sponsor link on our webpage at kickasspolitics.com. If you like Kick-Ass Politics and you want to keep us on the air, then please support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. That's GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and even more interesting programs in the future. That's GoFundMe.com kickasspolitics. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast and download all the episodes. Oh, and don't forget to leave a review on iTunes for a chance to win my book of the week. There are going to be two short, fun follow-up episodes to this podcast. In the first bonus episode, I'll give you my list of the top 15 sharing economy apps that will change your life. And then, in a teeny tiny episode right after that, I'll tell you about the 7 weirdest sharing economy apps that are either completely insane or pure genius. Check them out. There's actually some pretty useful information on there. And on the next full episode, I'll talk with Ronald Reagan biographer Dr. Stephen F. Hayward about the 50th anniversary of Ronald Reagan's groundbreaking speech, A Time for Choosing. This is the speech that catapulted Ronald Reagan from an actor to a political superstar overnight. And since then, it's become the manifesto of the conservative movement for the past 50 years. He'll tell us how Reagan ended up giving this speech for Barry Goldwater in the final week of the 1964 presidential election. He'll also talk about what makes it one of the greatest speeches in history, and how it almost immediately led to Ronald Reagan's election as governor of California just 2 years later. So be sure to download the next podcast. Until then, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.